And now, back to Stand Up with Pete Dominic on Indy, SiriusXM 104.
Okay, your favorite expert guest joins us right now. It's Dr. Aaron Carroll. And if you're not familiar with his background and his resume, well, I'm about to tell you what it is as soon as I find it on a piece of paper. Oh, there we go. He's an associate professor of pediatrics and director of the Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research at Indiana University. He's the author of two books that debunk medical myths. He blogs at The Incidental Economist, and he is a pediatrician, by the way. He is Dr. Aaron Carroll on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. If you're not following him, you're missing out. And the only reason he joins us is to get followers on Twitter, and he does have as many as anybody in his world, or almost as many, I would imagine. Dr. Aaron Carroll, good day, sir.
How are you?
Should also mention he's my BFF.
There you go.
It's Mother's Day. Melanie wants me to tell you, Sunday, not today.
Yes.
Melanie keeps reminding me that I should remind people that it's Mother's Day Sunday.
Oh, I'm all over. My mother's gift, 30 cent, kids' cards, 30 cent, and my mother-in-law will be here. So
yesterday, I plugged Noble Pies, and they got a bunch of orders. That's a great idea.
Nice.
A pie for Mother's Day, noblepies.com. Maybe more people will do that because they emailed me.
Probably got to get on it right now, too, because I imagine
Otherwise
you'll run out of time.
That's a good point. I don't know if they can even ship, but give them a call, noblepies.com. There is so much to talk with you about today.
Awesome.
What are you wearing?
Right now, just shorts and a T-shirt because I'll get dressed to go in later.
Right. The Oregon Medicaid study has gotten a tremendous amount of attention, and I'm afraid that you're going to explain this above my head.
No, never.
Always.
Well, it's hard to get below your head.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're the guy who will keep me grounded.
There you go.
Right?
Yes,
I was talking about that earlier. I'm sure you were listening. I've had like a real upper crust week. Yeah, I've been hanging out with all these intellectuals in high society. Yesterday, I interviewed the president of the Yankees. Tonight, I'm going to the Intelligence Squared debate and then the after party with the host, John Donovan, who was just on. On Monday, I went to this dinner for the New York Ideas Fest, which is part of why I was interviewing the president of the New York Yankees. On Saturday, I'm giving the commencement speech at my alma mater. And so I'm saying I'm afraid. I figured out what the fear was, which is that I'm afraid that I'm going to become friends with all these people who I want to criticize and take down. And then I will stop speaking truth to power because I will be power.
I think you vastly overestimate your ability to make friends.
Okay, thank you. Oregon Medicaid study. Why was this study unique first? That's a really interesting – you talked with us about this over a year ago.
Yeah, this is the thing. The study has been going on for quite some time. And if we want to sort of back up and talk about what the study is. And it's a very, very, very important study because it is a randomized controlled trial of health insurance that almost never happens. The only other time it's really happened in a large sense was the RAND health insurance experiment. It was decades ago, and we still talk about it all the time. So in Oregon a couple of years ago, they wanted to expand Medicaid to pretty much everybody who didn't have it. But it turns out they didn't have nearly the money in the state to do so. And so they had, let's say, 80,000 people that wanted Medicaid, but only enough money to give it out to a couple thousand, maybe 10,000 or so. And realizing they couldn't give it out to everybody, they decided instead to hold a lottery to say, we'll pick a number, sign up, and we'll randomly pick people to get it. Well, that offered a really interesting opportunity to do a randomized controlled trial without it being completely unethical. Because, of course, it would be wrong, we all accept that, for me to say to regular people, I'm going to randomly decide you can or cannot have health insurance. But
Right. Since
they weren't going to get it anyway, now it was an opportunity to do so. So they set up a very large randomized controlled trial. I believe that they randomized, I think, like 12,000 people to actually get the chance of getting health insurance. Not everybody signed up for it, but they're running a study to see what happens to people who do or do not get Medicaid. About a year ago, they released the first set of results, and those were things we call sort of process measures. They weren't actually outcomes of health, but they were things like, how do you feel about your health? Are you happier? Do you feel, rate your quality of life? Tell us, how you think you're doing. And all of them looked better for the people on Medicaid. And the people on the right screamed, these are measures that don't really matter. And the people on the left screamed, you know, these are real improvements. See where everything's going well. And then we sort of closed the books for another year. Now, this is the second set of results released. And this time, there was a combination of some process measures, some financial measures, and they also looked at some actual health measures. So again, they looked at sort of how do you feel? Are you happy? They also said things about, you know, are you having any problems paying bills? Is it easier to cover your medical expenses? Do you skip care because you're sick? And all of those things, again, looks great on Medicaid. But this time around, they also released some health metrics. They looked at the percent of people who have what we call a glycolated hemoglobin or a hemoglobin A1C above 6.5, which means diabetes. They looked at the percent of people who had high blood pressure. They looked at the average blood pressure. And they looked at depression. And they looked at some other things as well. And what they found was that depression got better, but when they looked at the percent of people with diabetes or the average A1C, they didn't detect a statistically significant change, nor did they detect a statistically significant change with respect to high blood pressure. And so many people seized upon that to say Medicaid doesn't actually make a difference in terms of actual health metrics, that this means that Medicaid is a failed program and that the Medicaid expansion should be slowed.
So basically, I've heard you use the phrase cherry pick before. And when you look at a study, any study, and there are 10 outcomes, if two of the outcomes go in line with your ideology or what you hope to have happen, you choose those two outcomes and you say, see, in this case, Medicaid failed. If eight of the other outcomes show that Medicaid is successful and helpful and a good government program, you just ignore those. Or maybe someone that is for Medicaid writes about the eight good things and leaves out the two bad things. Is that what kind of has been the whole?
No, I think it's less cherry picking in this case than it is, I think, an actual problem with the analysis itself. And, you know, here's the issue. And I've been, you know, I wrote about this last week, and I've been having people scream ever since that, you know, I'm trying to wipe away results I don't like. And first of all, I would say a few things before we even get into the actual statistics of this. One, I don't know that everybody buys health insurance because they believe that health insurance is what's going to lower their hemoglobin A1C and make them not have diabetes. Most people buy health insurance because they're afraid that someday they might be financially exposed to health care costs that are ridiculous, and so they buy it for financial protection. We've never run a randomized controlled trial to prove that Medicare reduces A1C or that private insurance reduces A1C. And if there's anybody out there that believes that health insurance doesn't work, I'm totally fine if you want to cancel your plan tomorrow. No one will do that. And so the idea that we were expecting Medicaid to actually reduce the levels of diabetes is somewhat crazy. I do diabetes research right now, and I can tell you that when we give people free care and we pay them to be in studies and we give them the medicines or other treatments, it's still very difficult to reduce the levels of A1C. We have a diabetes epidemic out there. If just giving people Medicare massively reduced the levels of diabetes, that would be unreal.
Well,
the
cure to the way to bring down the incidences of diabetes is probably a solution that has very little to do with medicine or health policy and more to do with economics.
That is partially true, but before you know it,
I see what I've been doing all week. All week I'm hanging out with smart people, and now I say smart things to you.
There you go. Well,
that's smart.
Sure, but the bigger problem is, and this is the real problem with these results, is that the study was, I believe, completely underpowered to detect these differences.
And this, what do you mean?
It's going to get a little bit technical. So, to do research where you're doing an interventional trial to say, I want to see if I can reduce the number of people who have a hemoglobin A1C above 6.5. There's a few statistics you would have to do to apply for a grant or to set up a study to do so. The first thing you'd have to say is, what difference do I need to see? What change do I need to see for us to believe it's clinically meaningful or clinically significant? In other words, is it a 10% reduction in diabetes? Is it a 20% reduction in diabetes? Is it a hemoglobin A1C that goes from average of 6.7 to an average of 6.5? You have to decide up front what is important and what do we believe would be success. Once you've decided that, you then have to calculate how many people do I need in my study so that I would be sure if I see that result, I can run statistics to make sure it's statistically significant. And it'll probably be a fairly large number because you're going to want to actually, you got to enroll a certain number of people, you got to get them all together, you got to keep them, you got to keep an eye on them, you got to check. And so you want to make sure that if you see a result where there is a change, that it's statistically significant. And you need a certain number of people with the disease to make sure that you have enough to actually detect that. Now, people will start screaming, this is a huge trial, it had 12,000 people in it. But not all 12,000 people had diabetes. Not all 12,000 people got the Medicaid. And by the time you figure out what percent of people got into lottery, what percent of those people actually got the Medicaid, and what percent of those people had diabetes, we're probably down to less than 100 people in the Medicaid group that actually had diabetes. The study found a point estimate where diabetes improved. The number of people with A1C went down. It just wasn't statistically significant. And the confidence interval, or sort of, you know, how much of it, how sure they are of the result, was enormous because they had a very small sample size. And in my gut, I believe that the study was never powered to detect how many people actually had their diabetes reduced. I think that it was rigged, not on purpose, but sort of they had Medicaid had both hands tied behind its back. I don't think it was possible that even if they found a clinically significant result, they were statistically powered to detect it. And they sort of say so right in the conclusions. Of course, that's not in the press release and it's not in the abstract. So I think the vast majority of news stories wouldn't pick up on that kind of small minutia. But I don't think the study was actually powered to detect enough of a difference, even if they found it.
I've been trying to read a lot of the right wing conservative criticism of this study, and it's interesting, and I could read some of it to you, but it's going to take a while to read some of it. So, and you're better at speaking. What have been the criticisms of this study? What are they trying to say? I'm looking at the National Review's Daniel Foster. And he picks apart everybody from Ezra Klein to Jonathan Gruber to Kevin Drum and Paul Krugman's responses to this study and to the results of it. Is there any accuracy to what conservative and right wing critics are saying about this study?
Well, it depends who they're attacking, because of course everybody doesn't speak with one voice, and so the different people he's attacking said completely different things.
Right.
If you got up and said giving health insurance out is going to immediately reduce the levels of diabetes, then yes, you would have been wrong. But here, I think, you know, most of the sort of arguments that I've seen against it fall into a number of camps. One is the idea that the study proved Medicaid doesn't work. Well, that is just flat out untrue. One, the study did not prove Medicaid doesn't work. It proved that it couldn't detect the statistically significant improvement given its sample size. Proving, not being able to prove the null, or disprove the null hypothesis, not being able to prove that Medicaid massively reduced diabetes is not the same thing as saying Medicaid doesn't work.
Here's the headline at the banner on Fox News, and one clip is Obamacare heartburn. Study shatters Dems' healthcare claims. So, you know, a lot of the arguments being made are that this proves that Obamacare, it will definitely be a failure, because they're obviously a huge part of the Affordable Care Act. Obamacare is expanding Medicaid, and this study proves Medicaid is a failure, and therefore Obamacare will definitely be a failure.
Well, again, it's like, what were the metrics for Obamacare being a success? I think I've said, I can't even count how many times in this program now, that the main goal of the Affordable Care Act was to reduce the number of uninsured. There's nobody alive who should disagree that Obamacare is going to reduce the number of uninsured. So if that was your metric of success, it's going to succeed. As a secondary metric, it was about reducing the cost of health care. That may or may not succeed. We're hopeful and we're optimistic, but we're going to see. The idea that it was going to improve quality was, I don't think I've said that once ever. Now, I have no doubt they can find a politician who will get up and say, Obamacare is going to make everybody healthier, and Obamacare is going to reduce the number. Maybe, I don't know, but I never said that, nor do I think that was the main goal. I think you have seen some people who've locked on to the number that, you know, people would say, you know, giving out all this health insurance will save tens of thousands of lives a year. I believe that's a quote somebody said. But again, it's time to take things into perspective. We're going to be giving Medicaid out to about 16 million people under the Affordable Care Act if it was expanded fully. This study was a study of like a couple thousand people. So if a handful of lives were saved that we can't detect, like four, if four people saved their lives because they got care faster in this study, then the metric holds, because this is such a tiny percent of the people who are going to get insurance under the Affordable Care Act that if just a couple of lives were saved, then Obamacare will save tens of thousands of lives a year. Now, I don't think that that's a causal response of something that happens immediately. I think that that could be over the course of years of care, that it's not like a yearly savings. But, you know, you have to sort of just take things into perspective. We're giving people health insurance. That is just the first step to getting health care. Health insurance gives you access to get the care that you might someday need. Fixing quality is so much harder, and I think it's a worthy goal. But that was not, I think, the goal of the Affordable Care Act. The goal of Obamacare was to decrease the number of people who are uninsured in the United States. It's about access. And on that metric, it's going to succeed. It's only recently that we all of a sudden decided that health insurance should be a powerful drug, that somehow that Medicaid should work like metformin or insulin and reduce the number of people with diabetes. That's not what insurance does. And getting health care is a much more complicated process.
We're talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll. As always, we're welcome and happy to take your phone calls. 866-994-6343 is the phone number. He is on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. You should be following him there, especially this past week. Lots of great stuff. The Incidental Economist is the blog where he blogs with Austin Fracht and others that share his background and pedigree, scholarship, academic credentials. And it's been cited quite a bit this week, obviously, because of this Oregon study. Lots of great work being done. If there's an award for blogs that discuss the health policy issues, I would imagine you guys will get it, as you're doing great work. But Aaron, Dr. Carroll,
yes.
When you were explaining, you know, how the study worked, Medicaid study, I had to close my eyes and focus. Because it's very difficult to understand and to unwind, and I don't know how anybody's driving was able to take that in, because it's complex. But what I think makes you so intelligent in a way is that you understand how research works and can break down any study quickly to prove whether or not it has proven what it says it has or hasn't. I think that's a really valuable asset that obviously you have, and that's what your job is to do. But explain, if you could, your take of why it's important to have people like you that can break down research, that can conduct research to get the most accurate outcomes on issues that obviously do mean life and death.
Well, I think part of it is, you know, this is a complicated. This is a nuanced, in the weeds discussion. I mean, this is not like a political discussion. This is the kind of thing that, you know, I think would often
happen. The Oregon Medicaid.
Yeah, I mean, the power calculations and the sample size of this study is a nuanced, you know, minutia. But to be quite honest with you, it's the kind of discussion that normally would happen when you are either applying for a grant or trying to get the paper published. And in the normal world, if you are applying for a massive grant to do a study to reduce the number of people with diabetes, this would never have flown because they would have said, well, you're not going to be able to detect a statistically significant difference, so why would we even pay you to do this study? It's important to remember that, and I'm not faulting the researchers for this. Please understand that these are really good people. This is not the way they designed the study. They were hampered by the fact that they only had enough money to increase Medicaid by a certain amount. So they knew how many people they were going to get. It's not as if they could have said, well, what we really need to do is quadruple the number of people. That's to get a good thing. They knew they could only give Medicaid out to a certain number of people. So they were doing the study no matter what. So I think what happened was they were just trying to measure everything they could. And then, so that's not the fault of sort of the grant review. Now, the fault of the publication, it's a second question. And I think there's an interesting debate to be had here on whether the journal should have said, the journal should have checked to see, well, were you powered to detect a difference, and is it worth actually having said? In fact, look, I actually am doing a research study right now that we're trying to get published that happened to be on some other disease process, but we detected a significant difference, and we're trying to get it published, and we're still, they're telling us our sample size was too small. Even though the NIH already said it was big enough, even though that, you know, everybody else said it was big enough, the journals are still questioning whether it's big enough, because this is a big deal with determining whether or not you have a significant result. And I am, you know, and again, I think we could have a debate about it, but I think if this study had been sent to me and to other sort of people for review, you might have looked at it and said, well, if you were never powered to detect a significant difference in terms of diabetes, even if you've had a phenomenal result, then you probably shouldn't publish it at all. Because if you do that, then people are going to assume that you were powered and you didn't detect a difference, so therefore Medicaid failed, when really Medicaid didn't fail at all. And that's a big deal, because you can see how this kind of result is being used in the lay media, in the press, and by sort of political people who want to push it one way or the other. These things have consequences. And
yeah, I felt terrible, but I had to take to task a colleague or former colleague of mine, Tim Farley, who tweeted out, fashions himself a very objective and does make a real effort to be as objective and down the middle as he can. And there was a tweet sent out from his Twitter handle that says, you know, the Oregon Medicaid study shows that Medicaid doesn't work or something like that.
It's like, well, that, what is that?
And to be fair to him, just to correct the record, he said one of his producers tweeted that out, and he did then tweet out, you know, a link to an Ezra Klein blog post that says that Medicaid does work and so on. But the point I'm making is that this is a guy who is an objective and was tries to be objective and was stating something that was untrue, not even an opinion.
I mean, how much to even blame? The press release basically almost said something like that from the New England Journal of Medicine. And if you read the abstract does not clearly explain about the confidence intervals or the power calculations or anything else. Now, if you read the paper, you will see in the discussion a very long discussion about the power and the width of the confidence intervals, and how the confidence intervals contained very robust improvements in Medicaid, but still fell within the confidence intervals. It's all in there.
The hell are you talking about? Confidence interval.
Well, not only that, most people can't get to them. If you click over to the New England Journal of Medicine right now, you can't read the paper.
Well, even if I could read the paper, most of us have no idea what the hell you're talking about.
I agree,
that's why we need you.
So even if we say journalists should be better, journalists, I don't know if they had access to the paper. I don't know. But the press,
and if they did, they would have a lot, you know, and especially in this atmosphere where you got to get out stuff out the door right away to win. Now, there's a lot of great work on your blog, The Incidental Economist. You and Austin are doing an awesome job covering this, and I urge people, if they have more questions about it, go to it. But right now we got a couple calls with questions on it. Ken is in Maine. You're on the air, Ken, with Dr. Aaron Carroll at Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. You should be following him. Are you, Ken?
Yes, I am.
Good. Go ahead, sir.
Morning, Pete. Morning, Dr. Carroll. Just curious, Dr. Carroll, do you think if the study population had a difference, let's say Medicare patients or even commercially insured patients, that the results would have been different? I know that there have been studies that have shown that education level can have something to do with the impact of healthcare. And I don't mean to assume that the population wasn't well educated, but I know there are stereotypes that Medicaid population is less educated.
Okay, so the difference is between Medicare, private insurance, and Medicaid, and of course, who qualifies for Medicaid? Are they generally lower income people, and does that necessarily mean that they're less educated?
By definition, these people were low income. They had to qualify for Medicaid. So by definition, they had to be, you know, making either like less than the poverty line or less than near to the poverty line. But it's still a randomized controlled trial in the sense that people in both groups were theoretically, you know, the people that got Medicaid or didn't get Medicaid should have been equivalent on every other metric, but whether or not they got Medicaid. Now, levels of diabetes are usually higher in people of lower socioeconomic status. Certain racial groups have higher levels of diabetes, and those racial groups also tend to favor often groups with lower socioeconomic status. So there's reasons to think that this population was different than you would normally see if we took a random sample of people in the United States. But even taking that, this sample was shockingly healthy. the level of people who started in the control group with diabetes was like 5.1%. That's way lower than I think the American average. It's also way lower even than the Medicaid population. It's even way lower than the population in Medicaid in Oregon usually is. This study was almost entirely run in Portland. So you're getting sort of a very tiny, bizarrely non-generalizable slice of America when you look at just Oregon and Portland. But the study started off with a healthier than expected group, which of course makes it even harder to detect the difference, because if it's already a pretty healthy group and their A1Cs are already pretty well controlled, how much of a difference could Medicaid actually make? So if everybody started off pretty healthy and you couldn't make anybody any healthier, then is that a failure of Medicaid? This is another thing that's like nuanced about this study that I don't think is getting a ton of attention. So it's a very non-generalizable group, and it doesn't necessarily represent everyone who's going to get Medicaid in the Medicaid expansion or how things would otherwise go. Now, you asked about would I see this difference with commercial insurance or would I see it with Medicaid. We're never going to do that study because everybody just assumes that private insurance is awesome. And tell me which group's going to give up their Medicare so that I could run this study. It's given that insurance is awesome for everybody but those who qualify for Medicaid. And so that is where it gets more philosophical. Of anyone who truly believes that this study is, or you know, goes out and says health insurance isn't health care and blah, blah, fine, cancel your health insurance. Put your money where your mouth is.
Right.
And I've seen zero people do that. So
thank you. Thank you, Ken. Thanks, Aaron. Thank you, Ken. Let's go to Joe. He is in Washington. Joe, you're on the air with Dr. Aaron Carroll. 866-994-6343 to join our conversation. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Good, Joe.
So I had a quick question, and I'm kind of a layperson on this. I'm in a quantitative analysis course right now at the tail end of an MBA, and I'm feeling kind of out of my depth, but I wanted to ask you guys, when you're talking about a sample size this size, and it sounds like the researchers, you know, basically defined a causal relationship here. I can't help but think if I did that for a paper in this course right now, I'd fail it. You keep saying to be fair to the researchers, but I don't understand how, you know, they could do something like this.
This is the thing. I think if you read the entire paper, if you really do, and you go all the way through the discussion, they acknowledge the limitations of what they were doing. And it's important to remember that this was not a research study that was limited by this was a research study that was entirely limited by the size of the sample population. They could not get more people into the study because they didn't have the money. And to get a randomized controlled trial of health insurance is not going to – last time was like decades ago. It's not going to happen again for a long time. They're going to do the study. I think I side with what you're saying to the extent that I wonder if they should have published the results of the medical factors at all, because they knew, or they should have realized at some point, they really were underpowered. I think their defense is if they didn't publish those things, someone would accuse them of trying to hide them. And so what they think they tried to do was publish them and explain them away at the same time. Do I think they did a good enough job of stressing that? No, because it slipped out. Do I think that perhaps the abstract and the press release should have reflected these things? Yes. But I don't believe that the authors were trying to hide this. You have to remember, some of these authors are the people that built the Affordable Care Act. I mean, I think John Gruber's on the list. These are not people who want Medicaid to fail any more than these are people who desperately want Medicaid to succeed, but some of them probably fall into one camp or the other. I think that they tried to do their best in explaining it in the discussion. I certainly wish it had been better. And I certainly wish it had been clearer, but I think, you know, this is not going to be a gotcha. Like, it's not where I'm, like, pulling out information that they don't have. I think that they actually would say, oh, my God, we put that in the discussion. I don't think it's in the clearest terms. I think it was written for an incredibly sophisticated audience that is unfortunately way too small. And I think to the general reader, it would have been completely missed. But I would almost blame the peer review process more than I would, you know, anything else. I think that should have been picked up there.
Go ahead, Joe.
And oh, by the way, you did bring up causality. This is a randomized controlled trial. That was the whole point of it, was it was supposed to be causal. It was supposed to be their ability to say Medicaid does or does not do this. And certainly we've been fine. I should say we, meaning the people who've sort of pushed the results in the past, have been fine with the fact that it is causally shown that it reduces financial burden, that it, you know, improves depression, that it, you know, it affects quality of life, and that it absolutely, you could say, causally does that. We can't say these other things causally, not because we don't like the results, but because it wasn't powered to detect that, and therefore the non-significance doesn't really mean anything.
All right. Hey, Joe, good luck with your MBA, and thanks very much for listening to the program. We appreciate it. We've got to take a break with Dr. Carroll, and we'll come back to your phone calls, which we have a couple of, but I'd love to have more. 866-994-6343. Dr. Aaron Carroll would love to have more Twitter followers at Aaron E. Carroll. And you should be reading him as well, The Incidental Economist. And he and Austin Frack do a great job covering this Oregon Medicaid study. But we're going to move off of that now, unless there's other questions, of course, and talk about a couple of other issues, like a new study that says Obamacare will bring down the cost of premiums, health insurance in New York State, as well as the Save the Children report that says the United States of America has some issues with newborns and death. And a couple of other things. And anything that you want to talk about, maybe we'll debunk a myth. Lots more after we take a quick break. We'll be right back. You don't want to miss the rest of our conversation with Dr. Aaron Carroll, or you could die, according to a study that's never been done. We'll be right back.
America's Next Top Model. Stand up with Pete Dominic.
All right, we're back here with Dr. Aaron Carroll, who joins us almost every Wednesday in the third hour of the program. We're always happy to have him. He does it for free. And we give him Twitter followers, at Aaron E. Carroll, at Aaron E. Carroll. Lots more to talk about and never enough time. So let's get right back to it. You there, Aaron?
Yeah, of course.
All right. Was here if you had left?
Never.
Coffee or pee-pee?
Nope. I was answering some emails.
Hey, tonight I'm going to this debate. Angrily?
Angrily.
What were they about? Are they personal attacks? Tonight I'm going to the Intelligence Squared debate.
Yeah, those sound interesting.
They're really, really interesting, and we're always joined by the moderator, John Donovan, who's a real cool, smart guy. And tonight's debate is about basically about the FDA and whether they're, you know, they don't move fast enough to get drugs out the door through, you know, trials and so on. And you've got these libertarians arguing that they, you know, probably one of them will say that they wish the FDA didn't even exist, but basically that they don't move drugs out the door quick enough, and they slow down the process for the pharmaceutical industry to get life-saving drugs out there.
Okay.
And obviously the other side will argue that they're not.
Yes. That was wise right there. Well, I have the debate. I think you just solved it right there.
What do you think, though? What do you think about the FDA?
First of all, I don't think it's ever like as clear as that. It's like that's like saying it's like all one way or all the other. I'm sure you can find tons of examples of moving too fast and moving too slow. I think Americans tend to be rather risk averse in general, and so having stopgap.
That's part of our culture, you think?
Well, yes, given the sense that, like, we, like, you know, I have to listen to panicky people tell me how, like, cell phones are going to kill them by giving them cancer. Or they, you know, everyone's panicked about all these, like, minutiae that could possibly have tiny, tiny, tiny.
And they're going to be kidnapped if they lived in Cleveland.
Right, exactly. Or, you know, your child's going to get poisoned on Halloween. Something that's never actually, like, happened from a stranger ever. But we're panicked about it. So the idea that we would somehow all of a sudden remove the body that's regulating pharmaceuticals. Can you imagine every time they found a side effect, how the world would lose its mind and how many lawsuits would happen if, you know, with this kind of thing? And we've had plenty of examples of drugs that have been approved that still have to be yanked from the shelves because
right.
No one has sort of monitored them. So the idea of removing it completely is somewhat...
Well, I don't know that anybody's going to argue that.
Okay.
I don't know if anybody's going to argue.
Who knows? But, I mean, or even lessening it. Now, there probably could be a robust discussion about, you know, people who are terminally ill. Could we loosen it to get them sort of more experimentation if they were perfectly willing and capable to say yes?
Is that why people will go to other countries for experimental drug treatment? Because they're not approved here or they're not available here?
Well, Well, sometimes they
hear a lot of people with cancer going to, like, Germany, I feel
like. But a lot of times they're for drugs that have been proven not to. I mean, you know, back in the 80s or when it was, Latril was real popular. You know, it was made from, I think, apricot pits. And everybody would scream that, you know, we were suppressing it. But it didn't work. And it had terrible side effects. And they proved it didn't work. And no one uses it, of course, today. But, you know, people were all trying to get it underground. Because when you're dying, you want to try anything. And that's totally human and understandable. But... you know, why do people go to other countries? That could be one reason, but sometimes the reason that those drugs aren't available in the United States is because they don't work, and because perhaps we have higher standards to make sure you're not being screwed. You know, we're so panicked about imports of drugs that they're going to be impure or not perfect. Well, that if you believe that, then going to other countries to get your medications, especially when they're experimental, should raise your hackles a little bit. So. This is one of the – I mean, I think it would be a phenomenal debate. I think it would be totally worth hearing because I'm sure there are pretty good arguments on both sides, and it's something we should continually reassess. But I don't think that we're crazily, you know, one side or the other, that we should be radically moving very quickly to one direction.
What's a hackle?
I believe that's like the – you know, I don't know if it's literally the hairs in the back of your neck, but it's the proverbial hairs in the back of your neck.
A couple things before I get back to the phone calls. You tweeted or you retweeted an Ezra Klein tweet that says that Obamacare could lower premiums in New York, according to a new study. Now, I'm not saying that you endorse this study, but your retweet does suggest that perhaps you imply that this study was well done and suggest that it's true that the Affordable Care Act could lower premiums in New York State, where I live.
Right. Well, one of the big arguments that people have been making is that everybody promised that Obamacare was going to reduce premiums. And that's not true. It will make health care more affordable for many people because even though their premiums are going up, most people will get subsidies, which will help them defray the cost. So even though the premium's going up, their contribution would probably go way down.
It doesn't seem like an irresponsible argument to be made if the piece of legislation is called the Affordable Care Act.
Right. Well, but here's the thing. In New York,
I mean, people saying you can't say that no one argued that it would be affordable. Obviously, you're not saying that. You know, many people did, but it's named the Affordable Care Act.
I want to know. It is. Well, again, will healthcare be more affordable? Yes. That doesn't mean premiums go down. That just means your contribution. But here's the caveat. In New York, it turns out premiums are actually going to go down because. You had already part of the Affordable Care Act in place in your individual purchase market. The community ratings and the general guaranteed issue, in other words, you already had the parts that said if somebody wants insurance, you have to give it to them, and you can't charge them tons more if they're sick. But you didn't have a mandate. So what happened was you had exactly what we've described would happen, the death spiral, you know, or at least hasn't gone now that far, but somewhat of a death spiral where only sick people buy insurance in the individual market in general, or more sick people, and then rates have gone so high, they're considered very unaffordable, but they're there.
Because we had that.
Now you have the mandate. The mandate's going to come and force all the healthy people into the market, which will actually lower.
To have a situation in New York where only a lot of people that were buying health insurance were buying it because they were sick or injured, and now the Affordable Care Act changes that variable because everybody will have to have insurance, which there you know reduces cost because
mandate. The mandate is going to come in and force healthy people into the market, and that'll lower the overall cost. So you're one of the few states. That actually will see premiums on net go down.
I was going to say, you know, you've argued in the past that when people and we've had countless calls and emails, and you've fielded this question or claim a lot that premiums are going up as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Employers tell their employees this. Lots of people report
that's
this.
Different. That's different.
But you have said in the past that there's no correlation that they would have gone up anyway. But in this case. The opposite is the converse is not that. The converse here is, well, no, for you can't say I can't say, hey, listen, the premiums would have gone down regardless of the Affordable Care.
No way would the premiums have gone down because there's no way the insurance companies are thrilled healthy people are coming into the market. But let me back up. Almost every call we've had where people are complaining about, you know, people, employers are blaming insurance. That's employer-based insurance. That's not what we're talking about here, because that market is untouched by the Affordable Care Act. The employer-based insurance market is almost entirely left alone. We're talking about individuals who want to buy
insurance.
Doesn't
the employer-based insurance market, isn't it affected by the individual market?
No.
It's not?
Nope.
It's not competitive with?
Nope, not at all. Completely different, because one is probably large, sometimes small group, but usually large groups that negotiate themselves or self-insure. And so that is one market where usually, again, like, I work for IU. They don't give me a health exam every year. It doesn't matter that I have a chronic illness. I get my insurance every year. It's the same price as everybody else that I get insurance with at IU. It's exactly what everybody wants. But if you don't get insurance through your employer, you have to go as an individual and buy it. Completely different market. And then they can look at you and say, no, you've got a chronic illness. We're not ever giving you a policy. Or if we give you a policy, we're going to charge you $30,000 a year for it. They can do whatever they want. And so individual market has been where people have been screwed. That's where almost all of the uninsured are. And that's who's going to – that's the 30 million plus people who are going to get insurance through the Affordable Care Act, either buying it on the exchanges or getting Medicaid. But everybody who has insurance already through their employer is a completely different market. It's relatively untouched by Obamacare, and it's going to continue as it did before.
All right, let me ask you this. I got a couple calls here. I really want to get them on with you, but I got to ask you about this study that I referenced yesterday, and Alfred reminded me that I was going to ask you about it. There's a new report out by an organization called Save the Children, which I think is a great organization. In that report, the United States...
Questionable.
Oh, really?
I'm joking. Oh, my God, no. With a name like Save the Children.
Well, yeah, but Focus on the Family
usually
is a great name, too.
Children. Yeah, but usually you're against children. Go ahead.
I am. Generally, I am anti-children, unless they're my own, of course. You're a bastard. I donate to random children all the time. All right. So in this report, the United States falls behind 68 other countries, including Mexico, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait, by the metric of the rate of deaths on the first day of life. Yearly, about 11,300 U.S. babies die the day they're born, according to this new report by the charity organization Save the Children. Why are newborn deaths in the United States so high?
Well, it's part of our infant mortality. I mean, this is certainly, again, I would hope that, again, for people listening to this show, I hope this is not news. Our infant mortality is the highest.
It is news. Are you kidding me? You really don't think that, you really think Americans know that?
We've only talked
You're
about
so
it.
Inside. It doesn't matter.
I said listeners to this program.
Okay.
I said listeners to this program.
All right.
We've talked about this
right.
many, 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 many times. Infant mortality in the United States is shockingly high. And there's lots of reasons for that, and people will try to explain it away by saying that we define a live birth differently than other countries, that if a preterm baby is born in other countries, that they don't call it a live birth, and that skews our statistics. But even when you normalize the definitions, it turns out our infant mortality is terrible. This is known. There are various reasons for this. A lot of it is because we have higher levels of premature birth than most other countries. There could be some genetic factors in that. There are probably some lifestyle factors in that. There's probably some health factors in that. It's also due to the fact that we have lower rates of prenatal care than pretty much any other industrialized nation in the world. But it's a horrible statistic, but I could show you, chart after chart after chart that shows it's been this way for a long time. And so will we do something about it? Well, hopefully one thing we could do is get people better prenatal care. Let's see if that makes a difference. That's one of the things that will happen with the Affordable Care Act.
It is Ann in Texas. By the way, if you're looking for something to do for Mother's Day, this isn't a live read, folks. Sorry, I didn't mean to make it sound like that, Ann. I apologize to you and Dr. Carol. But I Partners in Health is a charity that I support, and they sent out an email yesterday. Doctors Without Borders is another good one that's doing a similar campaign. Is you can donate like $70 for a birth kit for some of the poorest countries in the world. And it's, it's a great Mother's Day gift for a mother you will probably never meet whose child will survive perhaps because of your donation. So if you're looking for something to do, I'm doing that. I think it's a great idea. Go ahead, Ann. Sorry.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I really love this show. And I also love when you have Dr. Carol on. I work in pediatrics, research, drug, and development a lot with phase one and phase two trials. I actually originally called to comment on the Portland, Oregon study.
Mm-hmm.
And about how you were talking about, I'm assuming that the primary objective of this study really wasn't to deal with diabetes, determining the relationship at all. So I'm a little surprised that they were able to draw a significant relationship, as you had already mentioned out, based on the sample size, as it wasn't originally intended for that reason. But I just wanted to throw the question back at you as to whether you think that the risk factors for diabetes is obviously a chronic illness. Do you think that it may have made a difference if they were looking at the impact of people who had already had diabetes while, they were randomly assigned to whether they had insurance or not, whether those people developed even more risk of other complications such as peripheral vascular disease, et cetera, et cetera? I mean, were they able to get the care that they needed to prevent complications from diabetes, which we all know happen?
Yep. I think it's a great question. I think, unfortunately, it would take more than the 2 years that they've been doing the study to get enough people, first of all, with diabetes, and then to get those complications. Some of them take quite a bit of time to develop. Some of them are short-term, some of them are long-term. But I doubt in the 2 years that the study's been going that they're, especially given that they can't even, they're underpowered for A1C changes, it's very unlikely that they will be able to get some of the downstream complications that we would worry about with diabetes in general. They're not powered to do it, and I don't think they've had the time. So 20 years from now, I guess we'll see, but, there'll be a lot of things going on at that point as well. That they might be on different insurance. But, you would hope that in a perfect world we'd be able to measure things like that, but I don't think they've had the time or the numbers to do so yet.
And I have another comment to make when you were talking about the FDA and the regulation. And obviously, FDA is the I'm not going to say any comment about the FDA because, I don't want to say anything that misrepresents how I feel, because I do believe that they play an important role in regulating research. However, I do believe that when it comes down to the pediatric population, I deal with pediatric phase one, phase two trials, and it's extremely difficult for these kids to get the type of investigational medicine out there that they offer in different countries. A perfect example is for osteosarcoma. There was recently a drug approved all across Europe, MTP, which was developed here in the United States in the center that I work for with physicians that I work with. And they did about 20 years of research on this, LMTP. If anyone wants to look it up, please do so. This drug has actually been approved as standard of care therapy in Germany and all across Europe, but it has been rejected here due to, I can only imagine, kind of almost politically based things. And it's so unfortunate that children who have a diagnosis of osteosarcoma, which is a very poor prognosis of survival, can't be offered this.
Could it
go
be
ahead.
Medication? They haven't done the study. They haven't done enough trials in children in the United States to actually qualify for FDA approval. Because that's the biggest reason often is that, let's be honest, the market for drugs is so hugely tilted towards the elderly and adults that often, and I'm not saying always, but often drug companies don't run the trials in children to sort of get the doses, prove the safety, do everything else. It's one of the reasons that in the last few years the FDA has been offering increased patent times for if they will go ahead and do the studies in children and get approval. We've had to incentivize them to actually do studies in children with the same drug. So sometimes when the drug's not approved for use in children, it's because the studies haven't been done. And again, it's just you have to own that America's a pretty risk-averse place, and so lots of people don't want to be giving their kids drugs if they haven't been proven to be safe and effective, and we know the exact dose that we should be using and everything else. So now, if they've done the studies and the FDA refuses to approve them, I'll totally side with them. But,
Right. This drug in particular, I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm about to have to head into work myself. But as far as the LMTP trial, this is an oral pill. It's a medication. It's a chemotherapeutic agent, and it was given as an investigational therapy. The research was done on American children, and now our children are not able to get this drug unless they go to Europe because it has passed. The research has already been done, and it was not approved here.
I bet
it shows have statistical significance, and now it's being done. Now it's approved.
I have to look it up, though. I mean, because it's like, I don't
how
know.
Dare you have to look things
look
up before
up.
You speak
I
on
it.
Doctor, thank you very much for calling. Thank you for what you do as a pediatric, what does she do, a pediatric research doctor, Dr. Carroll? Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear what you find on her question. We're almost out of time here, and I'm really sorry for those of who we didn't get to your calls. I'm also very sorry that Dr. Carroll hasn't seen a noted increase in his Twitter following. That is extremely disappointing to me. You've let me down, folks. You've let me down. At Aaron E. Carroll is his Twitter handle. Two R's, two L's. You know, have faith in the replay, Aaron.
Yes, of course.
Look about, you know, in the 11 a.m. Eastern hour. See,
sure.
Measure that.
Right, yes.
I want to end with, as we do, there's a great question about mental health that I didn't get to, which is a great question. Matt, I'm sorry we didn't get to it. The decimation of mental health infrastructure, how we can get funding for it. I have an assumption that I make when I see people living on the streets, I assume that they've got a mental health issue. What do you think of that prejudice that I'm?
Well, you know, it's like I don't.
I mean,
know. Great
I'm
question.
Gonna.
I mean, you know, statistically, I think they certainly have a higher percent of mental health issues than not. But I don't know that all. I don't know.
Yeah, I just feel like a lot. We could talk for hours about our mental health issues in America.
That was a big problem in the 80s when we started turning people out from care onto the street.
Right. That was a Ronald Reagan initiative, as a matter of fact.
So, but, I, you know, in some cities that has improved. So, you know, you don't want to just sort of assume. But it's a higher percentage, I'm sure.
10 things. Are you ready?
Yes, let's do it.
All right. Here they are. That's Holiday Road from the movie Vacation. We always end with Dr. Carroll. Number 10, visual effects legend Harryhausen dies at 92.
Who?
Exactly. But 92, who cares? That's a good run, right?
Yes.
I'll take that.
Medicaid killed him.
Nine. Gun crime rate drops. The rate of homicides involving guns has fallen sharply since peaking in 1993. Yet today we read a 7-year-old shot his 2-year-old sister or something.
Oh. Well, I'm glad it's down. Of course, I was going to say since when, and since you're telling me since 1992,
yeah,
okay, did it take us 20 years?
Pew Research. Number 8, tanker crash kills 23 in Mexico.
That is horrible.
Number 7, lawyers say the Aurora, Colorado shooter wants to change his plea to insanity. Number 6, Dow breaks 15,000. How's your 401k looking?
Okay. Well, obviously everything's great. Everything's perfect. Stop talking about the economy.
Number 5, Italy port accident, at least 5 dead. Number 4, Pentagon says military sex assaults have risen sharply.
Well, evidently, even in, like, isn't the Air Force guy who was in charge of sexual...
Yeah,
like,
yeah, the guy in charge of sexual assault prevention. Yeah. Number 3, personal issues. Number 3, police face questions about missed clues after 3 women freed. Number 2, Mark Sanford wins congressional seat. There's hope for Elliot Spitzer.
Well, not only that, but I mean, like, didn't all the polls go the other way?
Not the last one. He was up by a point.
Additionally, major Republican district.
Yeah.
Delaware
becomes the 11th state to approve same-sex marriage as the number one story. We're out of time. Dr. Carroll, thank you.
Anytime.
Think for yourself. Look up everything you heard here, especially if Aaron Carroll said it. Follow him on Twitter, @AaronECarroll. Thank you to my producers and to all of you. Be the change you want to see. We'll talk to you tomorrow.